And you're from? Planet Earth.
I'm Dave, and I'm from Bellevue, Washington.
From Bellevue, so, yeah, Dave.
I'm Eileen Anderson, and I'm from Bellevue, Washington.
Well, my name's Dave Todd, Minnesota.
Yeah.
I'm in Seattle.
I'm known as Martin.
Christine Bowen, I'm from Maple Falls, Florida, Wisconsin.
Clyde Mountain, Lacey, Washington.
Ron Kidd from Huffman Bay, California.
Don Kidd from Huffman Bay, California.
Where's Half Moon Bay?
About 25 miles south of San Francisco.
Oh, yeah. But it's beautiful. So, yeah.
Karen Tilbury from Lindell, Washington.
And Ed Boone from Summers, Montana.
Kathy Shook, currently Seattle.
Yeah.
Karen from Tacoma, Washington.
Okay, and we can start the tape. No. And, oh, we're introducing ourselves.
Well, Marilyn Bowdy from Seattle.
Yeah, and you're the last one that you get to introduce yourself, so.
Frank Paul from Corvallis, Oregon.
Yeah, and I'm Dan Erlander from Tacoma. And just a little background, I'm one of the campus pastors at PLU and have been there this 7 years now, longest I've ever lived anyplace. And also, I served here at Holden, lived here for 3.5 years, so being here is often like a homecoming. And this week, Monday through Friday, I'll be leading the Bible study. And what we're going to do during these 5 days is go through the entire Bible. So if you're, you could just take one verse and spend 5 days on it. We're going to take the entire Bible and go through the Bible during these 5 days. And I'll give a little background on, what's that?
The aerobic version.
Yeah, this is Bible aerobics, or running through the Bible. And I'll give a little background. When the 3.5 years I lived at Holden, and then before that it was a 1 year period, several years before that, one of the privileges of living at this place for a longer period of the time is that some of the greatest Bible teachers, I think, in the whole North America come through here and teach. And if you're here long enough, you get to hear many of them. And several really stand out in my mind over the years. One is Bruce Birch, who teaches at Wesley Seminary in Washington, D.C. Another, Paul D. Hansen, who teaches Old Testament at Harvard. Another is Terry Fredheim from Luther Northwestern. And others who are just great Bible teachers. And I took the years to just soak in what these people were saying and the spirit that they brought. And then after the years, I started thinking, is there some way to take all of this inspiration about the Bible and get it into a little booklet that would be cartoons and pictures and would be inviting? So after leaving Holden, I started working on this book. And it was finished this year, and it's called Manna and Mercy, and it's called A Brief History of God's Unfolding Promise to Mend the Entire Universe. And what this was inspired by these teachers, but I think it goes back much farther than that. I grew up in a family that kind of loved the Bible and grew up on Edgar Meyer's Bible story books. Did anybody else grow up on these books where you went through the Bible with pictures? I'd like to just share where the title comes from, but also what we'll be doing today is kind of going through the major themes that I chose in this little booklet. Also, the encouragement is to color. All of the pictures are black and white, and people that lived in Palestine in Bible times had probably beautiful brown skin, so I encourage people to get crayons. And I even have there is actually Crayola produces politically correct crayons. Because remember when we were growing up, there was one crayon called Flesh.
Yeah.
And did it assume that there was only like maybe one color of flesh worth having a crayon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but this special box has all of the skin colors of the world, plus all of the hair colors of the world, so including blue-gray, even. So, yeah. So I've been going through this book and coloring in all the skin and different colors. So that's one thing you can do with this book. If you don't enjoy reading it, you can color the pictures. So now, what I'd like to do is in these days is just tell the story. Tell the story again, almost like the old song, Tell Me the Old, Old Story. And some of the inspiration for this book really came from two verses in the New Testament. And I'd like to just begin reading those, but first just share a prayer. Oh, Holy Spirit, come to us, and in the pages of this book, speak to us so its story may again become our story. Be with us now. Give us ears to hear, eyes to see. In Jesus' name, amen. One, if you want to look it up, is Romans 8. Romans 8, 22. Romans 8, 22. And my version goes, we are well aware that the whole creation until this time has been groaning in labor pains. And not only that, we too, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, even we are groaning inside ourselves, waiting with eagerness for our bodies to be set free. Someone have another translation? Would you read it? Romans 8, 22.
That the whole creation has been groaning and prevailed together until now. Not only the creation, but we ourselves, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies.
Mm-hmm. Now there's a mood in this verse that something is happening in God's promise, not only to humans, but to the whole creation. And I love the word mending. And it comes in a way from my mother, who mended everything. There was never a piece of worn-out clothing. You know, you always mended and you patched and you darned. Does anybody here still darn? To socks. You know, and it's so hard for me still to take an old sock and throw it away. Mending and darning, and it's a picture of God in the Bible. And the more I've looked at this, more the realization how, and this is a big word, I suppose, anthropocentric, we have read the Bible, meaning we have read it only as a story of human beings and God relating to human beings. And all of a sudden, these verses like Romans, that the whole creation is waiting for something. And the other verse that really called this telling the story is a verse from Ephesians, and it's Ephesians 1, 9, and 10, and I have it paraphrased in the introduction. I'll just read that. God has made known to us the mystery of God's will, according to God's pleasure set forth in Christ, as a promise for the fullness of time, to unite everything in Christ. Everything in heaven and everything on earth. God is doing something pretty big. And I think the Bible is a story of God working and acting and God finally never, never giving up. And one thing I realized in going through the whole story is constantly everything is going wrong and God never gives up. So part of our days together here, these 5 days, is I'd like to spend part of the time just telling again the story to you. And then we'll want to check some passages invite you, if you have time during the week, to do some reading in the Bible. And then by Friday, at 10 o'clock on Friday, we will have gone through the book of Revelation. But today, I'm going to start the story, jumping up to Exodus. And you'll see we'll go back to Genesis, but I'll begin with Exodus. And invite you to hear again the wonderful story of God and Pharaoh's Egypt. And I like to think of it this way, that God looked at God's world, and God looked at the whole universe and the whole cosmos, but then looked at the world and said, something is wrong. Something is terribly wrong. What can I do to mend it? And then God chose at a certain time and a certain place. And it all happened when God became extremely vexed. And I like that word, vexed. God became extremely vexed with a nation called Egypt. And I like to call it Pharaoh's Egypt. And that's out of respect for Egyptians today. How would you like to be a country where the name of your country is used all over the world as a symbol of what's wrong? Yeah. So to say Pharaoh's Egypt, it puts us back in that time. That thought came to me from a pastor who served a Christian congregation in Cairo. So to say Pharaoh's Egypt. And Pharaoh's Egypt was set up in a very specific way that everybody thought was right, or at least thought it was the way things have to be. And it was set up like this, that on the top was a god figure, and then right under the god figure was the pharaoh. I'll just say PH. And then the pharaoh was closest to God, was the son of the gods. And then right under the pharaoh were all the pharaoh's big deals. And then right under the big deals were all of the more average people. And right under the more average people were the slaves. And Pharaoh had a way to make sure that this order of people arranged would always stay the same. And lo and behold, Pharaoh thought of the most wonderful idea for keeping systems going that has ever been devised by humanity, and that is religion. Is that shocking? So over here you have the priests. And what the priests do is they get the word into everybody's mind that this is the way God intended that life should be, and this is the way God planned it, and therefore this is the way it is, and this is the way it was, and this is the way it will always be, because this plan is God's will. Isn't that a wonderful scheme if you're on top? And just in case someday, someplace, somewhere, somebody might start doubting the priests, you have the army. And I always like to call in this Egypt kind of triangle, the army is the backup system, just in case religion doesn't work. Religion is much better, because then the mind is totally committed to this. And the mind totally believes, but just in case there's a doubter, you have the army. And it's called death, you know, and that is kind of a deterrent to anybody questioning this system. And God is vexed with this way. Because in the book of Exodus, we have the ear of God listening. And from this group comes the cry of the slaves as their oppression increases and increases. Because what the people on the top have going for them is stuff and power. And they're closely connected to each other. And part of having this, all of this stuff and wealth and riches is to have all the slaves working for you. The longer they work and the harder they work, the more you have and the more you enjoy. And God doesn't like this system. And the slaves are treated brutally. And they cry out and God hears. And God does something that is utterly unique. He picks a sister and her two younger brothers to go and rattle the Pharaoh. And the sister is called Miriam, and her two younger brothers are Aaron and Moses. Now, is that a different way of saying it than you've heard before? Miriam and her two younger brothers. I just like it that way. And there is a whole tradition in the Old Testament that is the minority tradition. And one of the wonderful joys of Bible study is to pull out the minority traditions in the Bible that go through the Bible that are often the traditions that are closest to the center of the Bible story. And we're going to talk about that all through this week. The Bible has a wonderful way of arguing with itself, and you can find the strain. And one of them is that Moses and Aaron and Miriam, sister and two brothers, were actually equals in leading the people out of Egypt. Is this a new idea? Is it fun? Yeah. And part of that tradition is in the book of Micah in the prophets, Micah 6:4. And it's, listen, mountains, to the case, as Yahweh puts it. Give ear, you foundations of the earth. For Yahweh has a case against his people, and he will argue it with Israel. This is a people who have gone astray now, much later. And then God says to the people, my people, what have I done to you? How have I made you tired of me? Answer me. Isn't this the cry of a lover, you know, whose lover has gone astray? For I brought you up from Egypt. I ransomed you from the place of slave labor. And I sent Moses and Aaron and Miriam to lead you. You see how that minority tradition kind of bubbles up in the prophets. But anyway, to continue the story, these three went to Pharaoh and so wore down the Pharaoh that the Pharaoh finally says, I'll let the slave people go. Because remember, the word was, let my people go. And imagine the excitement. We are leaving our brutal slavery. And they shared a meal the night before they left that would forever be called, do you remember? The Passover meal. Unleavened bread, the lamb, the Passover. And then they went and they walked out of Egypt as free people. Then a problem called, and Bible scholars now realize that the wording of it is Red Sea. You know, we've often translated Red Sea, but the wording is Sea of Reeds. And they came up to this massive, muddy, marshy, reedy bird sanctuary. What do they call it now in environmentalism? Wetland. They hit a wetland. And lo and behold, Pharaoh had changed his mind, and we don't blame him. I mean, the system now is being disrupted. The slaves have left. You know, what do you do? My wealth. There it goes. So Pharaoh has changed his mind, and with his armies, he pursues the people. And imagine their plight. On one side of them is the Sea of Reeds. On the other side, the approaching armies, horses, chariots, soldiers of Pharaoh. And then God, the lover of this people, acts. And a wind blows over the sea, and the people walk across on dry land, and let's say they dance across. And when they get across, they see the armies of Pharaoh pursue them and get stuck in the mud. Stuck in the mud. And on a hill on the other side, they look over this deliverance, and they sing and they dance. And the tradition is it's Miriam who leads the dance and leads the song. Let us sing unto the Lord, for the Lord has triumphed gloriously. Horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. And there on the other side, they dance. Okay, now, if you try to picture what is God thinking, and one of the fun of doing this book was to try to figure out what God is thinking. And have you ever thought how audacious that is? You know, that I think it was Martin Marty once in an article said you just have to have a lot of humor, a great sense of humor, to actually think that you might know what God is thinking. And have you read in your local newspaper the letters to the editor of the people that are so absolutely positive that they know exactly what God is thinking about certain issues in our society? You say, God bless them, and we all, but always the reminder of to always say to ourselves, you know, we guess. You know, we guess, and once we've guessed, we have a real sense of humor about our guessing. You know, to think that the Almighty God who created it all, and like in the poetry of Matins this morning, brings the sun forth in the morning, you know, that we would be there and know the mind of the great mystery. But with a certain amount of trembling, this book is the story of God. You know, and I should have put a little thing at the very end, but I didn't. It should just say, this could be all wrong. You know, this could be all wrong. Yeah. But then part of being people of faith is that we believe that in quiet whispers and in events of history, you know, that God has whispered, you know, and given his ears to hear. Now, where was I? Oh, God, what is God thinking? Okay, this is what I try to guess is, here are the people, the slave people, that have come out of Egypt, they've gone over the Red Sea. The armies of Pharaoh have been totally frustrated, so they are completely free people. And God now must have looked at that people almost like a mother looks at a newborn child. You know, those of you who have had the privilege of mother, being a mother, to look at the newborn baby. And maybe I could ask you, would you ever say, now what do I do? Yeah. Anybody want to give it? Personal testimony. And I like to think God, like a mother, has now birthed a people who are on the other side of the marsh area, and there they are standing around, and they're dancing, and they're singing, and they have their tambourines out, and they're dancing some more, and Miriam is right in the middle leading them in their songs and their dancing. And God just says, now what do I do? What do I do with this, my people? And I like to think that God now has a dream. And this dream now comes out of the prophets. And I like to, we'll go back to that where it's written, but it's this. That God has a dream that I will adopt these people. Then I will teach them a way of life that is different than the way of Egypt. And the rest of the world will look at their new way of life and say, ah, let's try that. And then the rest of the world will come to their light. And then there will be peace on earth. But now God's problem with these people, and I'd like to state it this way. Have any of you been on what's sometimes called a Holy Land trip? You have a couple or trip over to this part of the world. Did you get to Egypt or did?
No.
Did, Marilyn, you didn't get to Egypt? Well, tour groups can go from Egypt to what's the nation of Israel, which means you can get in a tour bus in Cairo and go to Jerusalem. And do you know about how many miles that is from Cairo, Egypt to Jerusalem? Anybody want to guess? This is called guessing what the teacher knows.
400, isn't it?
What?
400.
Maybe. I took a little ruler on a map, which is inaccurate, but I'm usually inaccurate. So... And it was about 250. You were going to say?
I was just going to say 40 or 50 miles.
Oh, yeah. I think it's about like between 200 and 300. Yeah. If somebody is a real map reader, you could bring a report. But I looked at that, and then I also talked to somebody that went from Cairo to Jerusalem, and you get on the tour bus at your hotel in Cairo after breakfast, and then you stop for lunch, and then you get to Jerusalem late afternoon to check into your hotel. Also, if you were walking like a backpack and had your provisions and you did a good walk every day, you're talking about 15 days. Is that about right for 250 miles? 15 days of hiking. Few less on a bicycle. So, why did it take God 40 years? 40. Yeah, the traditional number for the wandering now in the wilderness is 40 years in the wilderness. You know, why not just get on with it? And you, a whole group of people like this, you couldn't do it in 15 days, but you could do it in 2 months. Mm-hmm. Right? If you, why is it 40 years? Go ahead.
It changed their way of thinking. They've been slaves.
Exactly.
Not
yeah, yeah. You're right on. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Funny was the word wander too, wasn't it?
Yeah, wandering in the wilderness. Someone at the earlier Bible study said that by this time Moses had taken over, and man never asked directions.
Also fear of the unknown.
Fear of the unknown.
They couldn't decide what to do. They didn't know what was out there. They sent scouts.
Uh-huh. Yeah, they were moving out into the precarious wilderness, the unknown. You know, just
they
cautious.
They had to live to a new generation that had not been under slavery.
Mm-hmm. A new generation had to come forth. Yeah. Any of you taken the Myers-Briggs personality? Yes, it's you end up with four numbers and four letters that describe your personality, and they're wonderful. Like in offices, you know, if you ever wonder why you couldn't work with somebody, well, all you have to do is take the Myers-Briggs, and you'll know how each of you works. And one of the graceful things about it is you begin to understand each other. Yeah, but the last letter, you're either a P or an I. And I don't, I'm not,
J.
I mean a J or a P. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it shows what I am. J. J or a P. And J's like to make decisions and do it. P's like to have everything in process. And your fear is getting there. You know, you're always in process, and that's what I am. And so I decided this was a whole nation of peas. You know, of course it took 40 years. They were just in process all the time.
Enjoy the process.
Yeah. But I think you're right on, and several of you mentioned it. And I'd like to tell a story that I think really brings that out. Are most of you familiar with the nation of Namibia? What's that?
What did you say?
Oh, I'm just, the questioner, if you're familiar with the nation of Namibia, it's a nation that's right next to South Africa and has been controlled by South Africa for many, many years. And the whole system of apartheid in South Africa was imposed upon this people. And there was a whole liberation movement. And 3 years ago, the nation of Namibia won their independence from South Africa and became a it was much easier to get South Africa out of Namibia than to get South Africa out of the minds of the people. I don't know if that's exactly you know, and some people have said it about the people of Israel. It was much easier to get them out of Egypt than to get Egypt out of them. Do you follow? And what do you think this pastor meant about Namibia, about the people of Namibia?
The security for them.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they knew there was a system.
And sometimes they wanted to go back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We're going to find that on the wilderness, you know, this dreaming of back in the security of slavery. You know, at least then we knew where we all stood. And there was a certain security, and you know, and the apartheid model, you know, has been so taught about who is superior, who is inferior, who is supposed to be in control, who is supposed to be in servitude, you know, who are the elites, who are the worthless, you know, who in their minds are worthless. Year after year after year of teaching. Now the long process of changing minds, liberating minds, the redemption of minds. You know, and I think it really gives us a picture of why we're talking about 40 years now in the wilderness.
Way of saying that,
mm-hmm.
as long as it takes.
Yeah, it's a symbolic number that it goes through the Bible as a time of real preparation and also a time of testing, right? Jesus was in the desert for 40 days and 40 nights. Were there other 40s? What's that?
The rain.
40 days. Oh yeah, the flood, 40 days and 40 nights. The flood of Noah. So it's a real symbolic number. Yeah.
Could have been a week.
Mm-hmm. So it's a period of time of testing and learning. Yeah. So now the people go into the wilderness, and I have a picture in the little booklet of what happens in the wilderness, where God says, "I am going to set up a school." And I like to call it the Wilderness School. And in the booklet, you can't see this, but it's on page 6. It's the desert, the wilderness. And what there are a bunch of little desks out in the wilderness. And then there's a teacher at a desk in the front, and right next to that desk is a wastebasket. And then behind that desk is a blackboard. And then on the blackboard it said, "Today's lesson, living as free people." Isn't that what the 40 years are all about? Because if you do not have the years and the years and the years of schooling, this was the only way people knew how to set up a society. And then you would just finally continue the same old thing. Over and over. And hasn't this been a picture of revolutions through the years? You know, the normal way of revolution, those on the bottom figure out how to get on the top, and then they throw those on top down to the bottom. And then they figure out how to get on top so they can throw them down to the bottom. And the cycle just goes on and on and on. And then every revolution has this dream that when we get in power and run things, then it's going to be a new age. And a new world, and then it's the same old thing over and over and over. Yeah.
In those situations, you know, I think you're right on. In those situations, does the religious system usually change, or does it, is it outside of the political thing in history?
Yeah. I don't, often, I think it's important to say often, that they're just kind of bound together, that ruling systems of power and elites, you know, find ways to get religion to become that kind of institution that bolsters the way that those who are in control. I think an example would be if some of you have studied the history of the church in Latin America and in Central America, that we tend to be isolated up here in North America. But during the early 80s, there was the persecution of Christians and a persecution of the church that some say was the greatest persecution of the church in the entire history of the Christian church, far greater than the Romans persecuting the early Christians. And this was, and we like, sometimes I say, what were we doing in the early 80s? You know, and probably the greatest persecution of Christians in the entire history of the Christian church was going on in Latin America. And if you look and see what happened in the early 80s, is that before that time, religion down there had worked perfectly. And it's been interesting to be down there and talk to some of the older people how perfectly colonial religion worked. And here it was Christian religion, you know, it could be other types.
Look what's going on today.
Oh.
In our world.
Yeah. Well, I'll finish this and then that's great. So, but what happened down there is that this system taught that the way things are is God's will. And those on the bottom, if they're faithful to their religion, they will be rewarded in the afterlife. But the important thing now is to, as a Christian, to be obedient to those who are in power, and then God will reward you after death. I mean, this is a very brief summary of colonial religion. In the 70s, there was a great movement after Vatican II, a great movement in Latin America of the church actually rediscovering the story of Moses and Egypt, and leaving Egypt, and a God who liberates people, and a God who changes systems, and then even discovering a Jesus who brought good news to the poor and liberty to the oppressed, as Jesus announced in the synagogue at Nazareth. And all of a sudden, this part of the system in Latin America began to crumble. So then what was left? But the police and terror and torture and assassination in order to keep the system, because the spiritual kind of slavery was crumbling. Yeah. Now, what was the question you asked?
No, I just said, you talk about the bad things that came out of the killing and the past, but they're doing it now.
Mm-hmm.
In the sake of religion.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so much of the terror in the world today is at least partially based on religion, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Whether you're in the Balkans or Northern Ireland, Christian, Arab, in Sudan, the terrible strife between religious groups. And yeah, my invitation is that part of the way of living in hope today, when things, there are so many bad things, is to go back to the story. And I think in the story we're going to meet a God who simply never, never gives up. And can we say that today? God still isn't giving up on this world. But you're right. I mean, it's a lot. Religion is the basis of so much of the terror and the torture in this world today.
Yeah. I had a feeling that the thing that upset this so-called triangle is the education of the common man.
Mm-hmm.
If they would have kept him ignorant.
Oh.
Like you find quite a few are in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And how far can that top go? Well, let's say in their taxation and that before they get revolution, there seems to be a certain, some know it and some don't know it. How far can we go having those slaves before there's revolution?
Yeah. Well, part of it is to, I doubt very much that Pharaoh had many schools for the Hebrew slaves. You know, that probably, that learning probably happened in the home.
But that's what I just said, is that the mistake was made in educating the common man.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mistake.
Yeah. Because then they begin to think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Last summer when we were in South Africa, one of the visits we had was on a church school that was totally torn down. All you had was stone walls. And we walked through these empty buildings, an empty chapel, and empty dormitories with just a few walls left, and found out that the South African government in the 50s had closed and torn down every church school in South Africa. And what?
Fear.
Yeah, because they were learning black children were learning that in God's sight they had worth. And so then the government took over all the schools, and there was only government education, which was very specifically education to teach low self-esteem and also to teach that your only place in life is servitude. And so the answer is, I mean, there were schools, but it's also a question of what was being taught.
Fear is a means of control.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Isn't this what Israel's done? It's closed the Palestinian
schools. Yeah.
Yeah. Another proponent in there is our technology and weaponry. They used to throw stones.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know. You know, it's hard to, you know, I want to be careful about that, but I just sometimes love to sit down and talk to some real pro Israel people, you know, and when you look at the history of Israel and freedom from slavery, you know, it almost seems like that's what's happening to the Palestinians today. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, so can I tell you a little more about Miriam?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah, this is a little sidelight. We have a little time because then tomorrow I want to go into the lesson plans in the wilderness school. Are any of you teachers?
Yeah.
And prepare lesson plans and
mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's what we'll do tomorrow. I've had so much fun kind of trying to figure out Miriam in the Old Testament because if you look in let's just look at the story. Start with Exodus 15. Chapter 15, it begins, it was then, this is after the people had come across the Red Sea, the armies of Pharaoh had been defeated. It was then that Moses and the Israelites sang this song in Yahweh's honor. I will sing to Yahweh, for he has covered himself in glory, horse and rider he has thrown into the sea. Have some of you sung that in Sunday schools and churches? I will sing unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously, the horse and rider cast into the sea. Anybody sang that one? Yeah, and it's called the Song of Moses, and it goes on and on. You can look in your text. It goes from 1, 2, 3 through verse 14, all the way through verse 18 is called the Song of Moses. And then it says, for when Pharaoh's cavalry with his chariots and horsemen had gone into the sea, Yahweh brought the waters of the sea back over them, though the Israelites went on dry ground right through the sea. And then the prophetess Miriam, Aaron's sister, took up a tambourine And all the women followed her with tambourines dancing, while Miriam took up from them the refrain, "Sing to Yahweh, for he has covered himself in glory, horse and rider he has thrown into the sea." And isn't it amazing that Moses' song gets 16 verses? No, 18 verses. And then when Moses' song is all over, then they tell the story once again very quickly. And then, oh, by the way, then Miriam picked up a tambourine and she sang one verse.
That's why it's called the Book of Moses.
Book of Moses. Right? Now, scholars who have carefully analyzed the text, and this is called detective work, and it is fun, and this is the fun of Bible study and Bible scholarship if you're a detective. You go back and by analyzing the language, you figure out, and it seems like at one time it was one song, probably Miriam's song, because she was always the songstress of Israel, and that some of the early men decided she's getting too much publicity. And so they gave Moses the whole song, but then there was enough Miriam people left that said, not fair, so they said, okay, we'll tack on a Miriam verse at the end. And just by reading the text, you realize there's something happened. To the text here with this little tack on at the end. And it's fun to think about early tension between men and women, isn't it? Do you think that might have happened? And then the scholars who have worked on Miriam, especially Phyllis Tribble, who's a Old Testament scholar at Union Seminary in New York, who has spent years figuring out Miriam. There's a strain of Miriam tradition that goes through the Bible. I love this. Now, let's go to the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers is mainly a book put together probably by the priests. Were the priests probably more men or women? Okay. And now notice in Exodus, what was Miriam called?
Aaron's sister.
Yeah, Aaron's sister, but also a prophetess. You know, the highest honor in Israel was to be a prophet. And here she is named in the book of Exodus as a prophet, meaning a preacher. A proclaimer, one who understands the mind of God and proclaims that to the people. She is called a prophetess. Now, the book of Numbers, if you look at Numbers 12, somehow there's put in a story here that Moses, that Aaron and Miriam are rebelling against Moses, who is taking over leadership. You know, it's a problem when three people are leading together. And I want to tell you the joy I have of being in a precarious ministry, because we at PLU have a team of three. And they had Moses and Aaron and Miriam, two men and a woman, and we have Martin, Dan, and Susan. And how does a team of three without one being called the leader work? You know, and I give thanks for God's grace or luck or something. You know, after 7 years, it's working. You know, and it's a real gift that has come to my life. But they didn't have quite that much luck. Miriam and Aaron criticized Moses over the Cushite woman he had married. That ever happened in families where you don't quite approve of somebody that somebody marries? He had indeed married a Cushite woman, and they said, "Is Moses the only one through whom Yahweh has spoken?" You know, what is this new stuff, this new kind of liberal, radical stuff of people coming up and deciding God has only spoken through Moses and not through Aaron and Miriam? Has he not spoken through us too? Yahweh heard this, and now Moses. Now, guess who's writing this? Was it more the pro-Moses people or the pro-Miriam people? Now, Moses was extremely humble, the humblest man on earth. You know, and you got to hear some of the people saying, "You got to be kidding." Suddenly, Yahweh said to Moses, Aaron, and Miriam, "Come out, all three of you, to the tent of meeting." And can't you see them coming out, standing in line, the three of them? And they went, all three of them, and Yahweh descended in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent. And he called Aaron and Miriam, and they both came forward. And Yahweh said, "Listen to my words. If there is a prophet among you, I reveal myself to him in a vision. I speak to him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. To him my whole household is entrusted. To him I speak face to face, plainly and not in riddles, and he sees Yahweh's form. How then could you dare criticize my servant Moses?" And Yahweh's anger was aroused by them, and he went away, and as soon as the cloud left the tent, there was Miriam covered with leprosy. A virulent, in my translation, it's a virulent skin disease, white as snow. And Aaron turned to look at her and saw that she had contracted a virulent skin disease. And then down in verse 15, Miriam was shut out of the camp for 7 days, and the people did not set out until she returned. And then the people moved on to Hazeroth and pitch camped in the desert of Paran. Now notice Aaron and Miriam were doing the same thing, criticizing the leadership of Moses. Who got zapped? Have the men ever gotten away with it? And the woman. Some have called this the crucifixion of Miriam. And the only other time, now Miriam goes completely out of the story now. She is not mentioned until in Numbers 20, it mentions that she dies. So Miriam, in the text, by those who wrote the text, is totally discredited. Totally discredited. And you only have now the tradition that comes forth in the prophets, like Micah, who says it was Moses, Aaron, and Miriam who led the people. Some of you are here for Singles Week. I think it's even more wonderful that probably Miriam was a single woman. And she got into deep trouble, and her leadership was not appreciated. And finally, the story itself was used to discredit her for all ages and all ages, except for a few people who kept the memory alive by saying, "Here was a prophetess of Israel." And then that thin line of memory breaks forth in the New Testament, and it is what some have called the resurrection of Miriam, because Miriam is the Hebrew name for bitterness. Bitterness and sadness. And what is the Greek name for the Hebrew name Miriam?
Mary.
Mary. Yeah. And notice. What?
Are you saying the only thing, or the main thing they had against Miriam was that she was a woman?
No, she was in leadership.
A woman in leadership.
Yeah.
That's the main thing they had.
Does that ever bother us?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
What?
I wondered if that surprised you. That they would be mad at a woman in leadership.
No, I'm just wondering if that was the only real thing they had against her.
Well, we don't know, actually. Yeah. But we do know that she was a woman, she was called a prophetess, a spokesperson for God, and she was in leadership. And the Micah tradition, the prophet tradition, names her as a leader with Moses and Miriam. But now in the New Testament, it is Miriam, Mary, the mother of Jesus, that God chooses to be the mother of the Messiah. And then you move into the disciple community, and who is at the tomb to be the first proclaimers of the resurrection? That Mary, the mother of Jesus, Mary Magdalene, and the other Mary. And say it in Hebrew because it brings it home with more power. There at the tomb is Miriam, the mother of Jesus, Miriam of Magdalena, and the other Miriam. And in a way, God is saying, I restore the gift of prophecy to my Miriams. So I think that's beautiful. Yeah. The wonder of God always having to counter the beautiful gifts that God gives to some people that other people don't appreciate. And now it breaks forth in the New Testament. Well, okay. Any questions about this or about this whole kind of side journey?
I think we have the same thing going on now for Hillary Clinton.
Oh, yeah. How do you say her?
Well, I'm going to tell you a little story her the other day.
Yeah.
Air Force One and Air Force Two collided in midair. And so they were all killed and run up to heaven. Now, this is my joke. This is a
book. Okay.
And the first one to come up was Al Gore. And God said, who are you, Al Gore? What did you do? I was Vice President of the United States. Okay, he said, sit on my left. Next door is Bill Clinton. And he said, who are you? Bill Clinton. He said, what have you been? Oh, he said, I'm President of the United States. Okay, he said, sit on my right. Hillary came up and he said, who are you? She said, I'm Hillary Rodman Clinton. And sir, you're in my chair. I'm a firm believer.
And say how that kind of fits into what we've talked about.
Pardon?
Say, you know, share how that kind of fits.
Fits now, yes. I mean, it's the same thing now.
Mm-hmm. It's attitudes of men toward women.
Yeah, but this thing just keeps doing itself over and over again. Mm-hmm. It's just a continuous revolution.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well.
I thought, from years back, but men in general, the male species.
That's like us. Go ahead.
Is frightened, and not only that, but don't understand women, just the female sex. They're just different, and they don't understand, and they're afraid to let a woman get ahead because of fear. They just don't understand. And I think, like when I was quite young, the teacher, like in a math class, there was a boy who was the first to get his paper done and it was correct and came out. And she says, oh, well, now see, for another woman to teach a class and say that boys are always smarter and that's why they get ahead in the math classes. And you know that, I don't remember how old I was, but it really irritated me. I said, by golly, I know. He's not any smarter than I am. Mm-hmm. And so the next time, every week we had one of these tests. She put the paper down on our desk, you know, and then said, turn it over and start. Turn it over, and I started. I went right down the list, you know. And I was the first to get up to the desk. And you know, I never thought of myself as being so smart, but by golly, that boy isn't any smarter than I am.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, I was just defeating or contracting what she said. Well, boys are always smarter in math, you know. Why did they do that? So I think, you know, that's when you're really starting young.
Mm-hmm.
With ideas, you know. And looking at life, looking at a lot of things.
Isn't it fun in a way to say that that goes all the way back to Bible times?
I didn't hear it.
Isn't it fun to say how that goes all the way back to Bible times?
Yeah.
Fun problem.
Isn't the right word.
Yeah, that's a man's word, probably.
But you know, Tom.
Say it again. What do you?
Fun?
Yeah, tragic would be the. Tragic would be the.
Well, it describes the, you know, the depth of the problem and, mm-hmm. and the paradigm that we apparently have operated with for centuries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because the way I see it is the, you know.